This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello there, it's Jamila Jamil. Are you by any chance listening to this podcast promo while out on a walk? If so, good for you. That's going to make both your mind and your body feel better. On my podcast, I Weigh, this month, we're going to be exploring mental health and talking to amazing guests about other things that you can do to make yourself feel better with guests like Simon Sinek from The Optimism Company, therapist Vienna Farren, comedian Neil Brennan, and more. Listen to I Weigh wherever you get your podcasts.
The year is 1991. It's 100% pure adrenaline. Other guys snort it, jab a vein for it, and some people podcast for it. The movie, Point Break.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to
Unspooled.
I am Paul Scheer, joined, as always, by Amy Nicholson. We are talking about great movies, and this is truly one of my faves, Kathryn Bigelow's Point Break. Amy, we're going to get into it.
We are going to get into it. We're going to get into it like a surfboard cutting through the waves, man.
That's right, and we're going to do it because you are one radical son of a bitch. And you know, this movie, I think, took a long time for people to appreciate its greatness. Truly, it has always been a film that I think is very high up as far as great action films of the 90s. But in recent years, I think we've been able to look at this film as something even deeper than what people saw the first times they saw it.
Yeah, I'm really interested to have this conversation with you in this episode, because the thing is, films don't change, but audiences change around a film. And the audience has changed in a big way around this film. I have changed in a big way around this film. And I want to explore all corners of that. Why we take things seriously later that we don't take seriously in the moment.
I think of this movie like an Indian dish, which is, it's a lot of very strong spices that are put together and they work perfectly. I mean, you are talking about truly a rogues gallery full of large, bombastic personalities. I mean, we are looking at truly a who's who of crazy, from Gary Busey, John C. McGinley, James LaGrosse. I mean, and the king of it all, Tom Sizemore.
He was working deep cover until you
think decided. I like this hair, man. You think I like these clothes? My wife wants me to stay at Ramada. I've been working on these fuckers for 3 months. 3 months! Now, I finally got him wanting to play Wheel of Fortune with me so I can find out who the suppliers is, and you fucking cowboys show up.
Nice tattoo, Deeds.
Oh, you like that, Pathos, huh? Fuck you.
Uncredited Tom Sizemore, because he's playing an undercover guy coming and screaming.
And I just think that's like, for Kathryn Bigelow to mix all these things, there's an argument to be made that, you know, the balanced nature of, like, Patrick Swayze being very zen, and then this kind of newer Keanu Reeves. I don't think he's a great actor in this, but I think he actually balances out this high spice gumbo in a really perfect way.
Okay, before you make me hungry, let's just do this podcast, man. I'm excited.
All right, so you know what, Amy? I'll get you two. Unspool it. Unspool it. The year is 1991, And this script about bank robbing surfers has been kicking around for 5 years. It started back in the mid-80s when a waiter named W. Peter Iliff agreed to write a script based on some shady characters he met serving beers on the beach. The script made it to Ridley Scott, who was like, yes, this is my version of a big, fun, spectacle movie, and what my brother Tony Scott is doing right now with Top Gun. This could basically be Tom Cruise as a bank robber, but maybe Charlie Sheen or somebody instead of Tom Cruise. You know, and Ridley's team even built a set, and then the whole thing falls apart.
But the script option eventually gets to James Cameron, who is like, my wife, Catherine Bigelow, could direct the hell out of this. James and Catherine add their own touches to the script. One of them is switching the bank robbing gang from the dead presidents to the ex-presidents, because as James Cameron says, Reagan robbing banks when he is just 3 years out of office is so much more interesting than George Washington.
Now, the movie changes names from Johnny Utah, named for the FBI agent who goes undercover as a surfer, to Riders in the Storm, which is a kind of surfy title, but not really. And then it eventually becomes Point Break. Now, Catherine Bigelow has one actor in mind for Johnny Utah, Keanu Reeves, and no one is into it. But she swears she can transform Ted from Bill and Ted into a legit action star. And everyone agrees that Patrick Swayze is perfect for the other lead, Bodie, who heads up the surfers. Johnny and Bodie connect over their shared passion for going to the extreme. It's a true bromance. But Johnny is also dating a surfer chick named Tyler. That's Lori Petty. And he's trying to earn the trust of his FBI buddy, played by Gary Busey.
Point Break was released on July 12th, 1991, and people had a hard time taking a film about bank robbing surfers starring action hero Keanu Reeves seriously. The movie did okay. It was number 26 at the end of that year's box office charts, while James Cameron's Terminator 2 Judgment Day, which was released just 9 days before, made almost five times as much money and ended up at number one. And James Cameron left Catherine Bigelow for that movie star, Linda Hamilton. But in 2010, Bigelow would beat him out at the Oscars when The Hurt Locker took down Avatar for Best Picture and Best Director. The thing is, though, today, now that we have had decades to get used to the idea of bank robbing surfers, Point Break, I believe, is a better film than The Hurt Locker. And also now, we take Keanu Reeves seriously as an action star, because Point Break led to Speed, which led to The Matrix, which led to John Wick, which led to the revolutionary final idea of, hey, Keanu Reeves is actually a pretty good actor. So that brings us to what was in the zeitgeist that July of 1991. Well, the number one song at the top of the Billboard charts was the same as it was when we did our Terminator 2 episode. That was Paula Abdul's Rush Rush. But you might remember the special thing about that music video. It is a shot-for-shot remake of Rebel Without a Cause, starring, in the James Dean role, Keanu Reeves. And in 1991, people thought casting Keanu as any type of serious actor was at all really, 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 really silly. Even Keanu did, saying, quote, it was another regurgitation of icons and culture by the American media. So let's listen to Keanu Reeves' James Dean right now.
Can I ask you something? Have you ever been in love?
If I was, I didn't know it. And you?
No. Isn't that terrible?
Terrible. No. It just reminds you that we're all alone, that's all.
Funny thing about that line in the song that's in the extended video cut, which you can see online. He and Paula Abdul, who is being the Natalie Wood, are going through a dialogue bit that is in the original script for Rebel Without a Cause, but it actually isn't in the movie itself. So they're going like deep cut rebel. Just saying that. But he also does the screaming and the playing with the little toy monkey.
I don't remember that video at all. And my first order of business, when we are finished raising this movie up to where it belongs, is to watch that video. Holy shit. Amy, what an introduction. I mean, this movie really went through so much to become what it is. And this movie is a film that, as you alluded to, launched softly, and has now become a movie that has been remade, a movie that has been transformed into off-Broadway plays. I mean, you've seen Point Break live. It plays out here in Los Angeles a lot. It is a movie that I think does exactly what Catherine Bigelow wanted to do, which is launch Keanu Reeves into this movie star, this action hero. I mean, that truly is probably the biggest gift that this film gives to cinema, right? Recontextualizing him.
Yeah, I mean, part of why we're doing it now is because we are, I think, finally getting our stunt category at the Oscars. And I would say that's partially due to the credit of John Wick, which is definitely due to the credit of Point Break. I mean, it is the slow build of taking this movie seriously that I find fascinating. Even Point Break Live, like you just mentioned, that was huge here in LA, like what, 15 years ago? And when it was huge 15 years ago, people still thought, hey, this is a stupid movie and Keanu Reeves is a bad actor. And you can tell from the way that it was even presented.
The bank robberies spill into the audience and out into the street. And fake blood spatters cringing spectators. Gary Busey stopped by one night to add to the chaos. Of course, tonight's Johnny Utah doesn't know his lines, so they give him cue cards.
Thank you.
But then John Wick comes out, and finally, I think, is when we turn this little mirror back into 1991 in this movie and really began giving it its props.
Well, let me just say, I think two things can be true. I think that Keanu Reeves had a renaissance before John Wick, but I also think that this is Keanu Reeves not really at the peak of his ability. Like, he is not great in this movie. I love this movie. I love him in this movie, but he has gotten so much better. I mean, and he should, right? He should. He's a young guy here.
Yeah. To use a surfing term that is actually not a surfing term, he in this movie is on his own unique wavelength, right? Like,
definitely not a surfing term.
Sounds like it should be, though. But like,
yes,
when he is in character as an FBI agent pretending to be a surf bro, you know, being like, oh, you got a spider in your hair, brah.
Got it.
Hey. Leave some hair, man. What is it?
Saved your life, bro. Close one.
I mean, he's kind of at that moment being like, I am going to use all of my acting ability to play a guy who's acting as bad as people think I actually act in the Bill and Ted movies.
But at the same time, I like that performance. I like that choice. And that's the interesting thing about this movie. You have these personalities that probably shouldn't mesh, but do so effortlessly. And I have to say, I mean, Gary Busey as really your straight man, like that's what we have. Like Gary Busey is obviously he's quirky, but he's smart. He's the elder. Like, this is an odd role for Gary Busey.
By the way, Busey coming into this movie, having like a huge spiritual action, extreme lifestyle revelation of his own. Do you remember this? That like in 1988, Gary Busey had a huge, huge, huge accident when he was riding his Harley.
And yes.
He split his skull open. He died temporarily in the operating room, he said. And he gave interviews like at the moment to like People magazine about how he went to the other side and he met angels. And these angels, he met three of them. They talked to him in this kind of androgynous voice, he said. He said he was looking at his body as they were talking to him and he was 1 foot long and a quarter of an inch wide. And the angels explained to Gary Busey that that was his soul, that the soul of a human lives in the column of its spine. And he's talking to these angels and that they're making him feel so loved. And they tell him he has a choice. Is he going to go back to his body or is he going to continue with them along and meet his destiny? And he was like, I'm going to go back. I choose to recover. But as he was recovering, he got a second visit like weeks later from the Grim Reaper who showed up in his hotel room. And the Grim Reaper was 7 feet tall. And he told him that he has to get better and he has to use his gift. And that this was just a huge, huge like paradigm shift inside of Gary Busey himself. He said like up right before that point, you know, he had just gotten, you know, a lot of like Academy Award attention for the Buddy Holly story. He was kind of losing it. He felt like he'd gotten successful way too fast. And so he was being like mean on pictures. He was hard to get along with. He was being really aggressive. And that this accident told him to stop and get his life in order and be more gracious and go through the world, you know, in a way where he was enjoying the process. And that's a huge, big like monologue about what Busey was going through. But that is the Busey we're getting in this film, is spiritually awakened, going with the flow Busey.
Well, I wonder how long that lasted, because I was on a movie where I saw him. So, you know, Interesting. Interesting. You know, maybe that was only about a 6-month window.
Wow. You know, we're all shades of gray, man.
Exactly. But the casting of this are all these big personalities. So in a way, what Keanu can't bring to the table as an actor as of yet, it doesn't matter because it kind of fits into this giant, like, action movie gumbo that they have created. You are just thrust in to energy, personality, and Keanu Reeves is a great offset to that because you have the loudmouth, you have the Zen dude, you have this bureaucrat who, John C. McGinley, amazing in this.
Hey, you're a real blue flame special, aren't you, son? Young, dumb, and full of cum. I know. What I don't know is how you got yourself assigned out here to Los Angeles with us. I mean, hell, I guess we just must have ourselves a shortage, huh?
That performance right there, like, that tells me in moment two of the movie, like, get on board. You're either going to catch this wave and have a great time, or you're going to fight against it and find yourself washed up at the beach. And I feel like that kind of pulse, that kind of dialogue is present in everything that this movie does. And that's where Kathryn Bigelow's genius is. I mean, from the lighting to the action to the acting, even to that dialogue, young, dumb, full of cum. Yes. Yes.
And I think when you hear that line, I don't know if you're supposed to laugh. I don't know if you're supposed to gasp. I don't know if you're supposed to be like, whoa, bro. Like, you kind of just get this mix of like every reaction at once. I mean, this is a movie that comes in just hot and hard, right?
Yes.
You got the slow-mo surfing, but then it's like boom, 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 boom. Cross-cutting, 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 cross-cutting. Swayze's wet in the surf. Keanu's wet shooting guns. You know, boom, you go straight into this like screaming conversation when he enters this office. And then boom, you go straight into like this other dominating, like entering into the bank vault. People's got their guns out. People are falling down. The look of it, the look of people in the bank as they like fall to the ground in this opening shot, it's like rough. It's like sudden. It is hard. It is fast. Like Kathryn Bigelow is just like, boom, gunning it immediately.
You know, before we get too far into our discussion, I think we should just talk about the way that this movie looks, because you're right. It opens up in this gray rain, you know, nature over man. And it ends in the same way. I mean, the movie is really about, you know, trying to tame nature, trying to be one with nature, right? There's an element here. And that I love how thematically this movie goes from gray. And then we go into this grime of this bank robbing department, right? This kind of bureaucratic world where like business happens, where, you know, people work, but they don't live.
Where it's data. It's data, data, data. We
Yes.
use data. We use science. That's what we believe in. We believe only in cold facts.
Overhead lights.
Yeah.
Just ugliness. And then the movie opens, like, push. Just explodes into this beautiful light, the sun, the movie. You can feel the pavement being hot. Like, it has that energy throughout the rest of the movie. Like, we're in the world. And I just think, obviously, Kathryn Bigelow, what can't she do? I mean, at this point, she's doing action. She's doing sci-fi. She can do drama. She really is this Swiss Army tool director who I think gets great performances and also does something that's a little bit rare, which is gives you a movie that we're very familiar with, but in a way that you've never seen it done before.
Yeah, and not in a way that you've never seen before that is just the way people thought this was a film they'd never seen before. I've never seen Bank Robbing Surfers, you know, not just in
right.
the gimmicky way of it, but in her... I think she has a really beautiful and poetic way of storytelling. Even the way you're emphasizing like the gray at the beginning, the gray at the end, it makes me think about her saying, basically, this is a movie with gray morality. You know, that Patrick Swayze is not a villain.
He's not.
He's an anti-hero, you know? And I would say that, you know, our character of Keanu Reeves, Johnny Utah, he's the hero by a traditional stand. But honestly, what is he doing? You know, robbers say, you know, we rob people, but nobody gets hurt. We don't shoot anybody. Nobody, this is not worth dying for. You know, like they say early on, the money in these banks are insured. Nobody should be dying for this, right? Even their ex-president's speech. We're living in a society where, like, we are all getting robbed. We're just calibrating it. We're recalibrating the score here.
Hands up!
Hello, 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 ladies and gentlemen. We are the ex-presidents, and we need just a few moments of your time. We've been screwing you for years, so a few more seconds shouldn't matter. Now, should it? On the floor, the money's insured, so it's not worth dying for. How you doing, Dick?
Just implementing our own personal plan of deregulation, Mr. President.
When you listen to this movie now, okay, bank robbing is bad, but Patrick Swayze makes some really good points. And like the fact that Keanu Reeves kills people over this money, gets people killed over insurance money.
That is at the end. He doesn't kill. I mean, that
but
is.
People die because of this pursuit.
At like, the end.
Are
but
we
I mean,
siding with the banks? Are we siding with the banks over spiritual Swayze?
When Swayze loses control, that's when everything goes off the rails, right?
Oh, absolutely.
But I'm saying, but like, as we are introduced to these robbers, they are committing technically harmless acts of crime.
Somebody
no
might
one's getting
call
hurt.
It Robin Hoodness.
Yes, I agree with that.
Robin Hoodness?
Yes, I do know. Robin Hoodness. Yes, that's a surfing term. Let's go back to Catherine Bigelow for a second. And Amy, you know that in feminist theory, the male gaze is the act of depicting women in the world through a masculine heterosexual perspective that presents, you know, women as sexual objects, right? For the pleasure of the heterosexual male viewer. I think that in this movie, what we're seeing is Catherine Bigelow doing something I like to call the female gaze, which is something that is a little bit more empathetic, which is something that actually pulls you into characters. We're seeing these guys, and I think there's a reason why many people think of this movie as like, oh, they just want to fuck each other. I don't think they want to fuck each other. I think that we're actually watching people have a real connection.
I do think that you are right that a female director is putting in not even just that gaze of like watching them with like, hey, check that out,
right?
But also this way of, through her lens of looking at men, their dynamic, violence, adding her special thing about how she thinks men bond, why she thinks men bond, why she thinks men are into guns. I mean, she just, the number of times she says guns are dicks in this movie. Have your gun. Hold your dick. Here's a gun. Here's a dick. That like everything they do is sort of tied with this idea of like, if I can't get my man, I'm going to shoot my gun up into the air and it's going to look like the actual screed incarnation of like impotence. I couldn't pull it off. And that's how I have to get my release. You know?
I mean, I would even argue that the final bank robbing scene, we don't really see a full bank robbing scene from entrance to exit in the film. We see moments of it, right? We see the first sequence. Then we see like a version of the bank robbery happening outside of the bank. And then finally at the end, we get our money shot. We go from the van in that amazing one-er, and you start to see the chaos of it, right? We've been leading up until this. Oh.
Yeah, I love that tracking shot because it's like POV, and you don't know for sure that Keanu even went in the bank with him until that POV finally turns around. And you're like, oh no, he's definitely there.
I know. And I wish that shot went on a little bit longer too, because it really is electric, and it was jarring that it stopped so suddenly when, you know, we cut over to him.
Yeah.
But I will say, to your point, just to make sure I put a little bit of a fine point on what I was saying, I think the reason why people think they want to fuck, or this is a movie about dudes who are in love with each other, is because the female gaze is different than the male gaze. It emphasizes this emotion and intimacy, right? This respect between people. Like it is a more mature relationship. And we sometimes are so immature that we can only see people who connect on that level as being something sexual, right? Like I love the way that you even see Johnny Utah and Lori Petty. And I know I'm mixing up names and characters and everything.
Yeah, Tyler. I think yes. It's interesting she's given a really specifically gender neutral name.
Well, they actually wrote her to be a lot more badass after Keanu joined in. I think they wanted to change that character. And, you know, this is interesting, too, that James Cameron did do the rewrite with Kathryn Bigelow on the script. But because of WGA rules, he didn't get credit. But their big issue with this movie was, how do you create this character that isn't just the woman? And she does fall victim to some of those traps, but I think she's way more interesting. And I actually buy their connection. Now, is it under false pretenses? Yes. But I also think that that shows how Johnny Utah is a good undercover cop. Like, he lies about his parents dying. He gets down on her level. You see this spark happen. You know, I don't know if it's going to last forever, but I definitely believe there is something between the two of them.
Well, yeah. I mean, what do we know about James Cameron? He has a great history of writing strong female leads. And I don't want to make this as like a James Cameron thing, because he's married to a strong woman at this time who's a strong filmmaker. This is something they have in common, you know? This right. is something they share, that they would go on to share. And the way that they have Tyler here is like elevated from, I think in the original script, she was just more of like a classic blonde beach bunny sort of type. Even by casting Laurie, which was very much Bigelow's decision, you can hear them talk about it here in this documentary about the making of the film.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting choice. That's primarily Catherine's choice, really, to go against type instead of the California girl, blonde, you know, and just to go with more of a physical, athletic type person.
I mean, that is definitely such a Bigelow move, because I feel like only female directors really understood the power of Laurie Petty on screen, what to do with Laurie Petty on screen. All of Laurie Petty's best roles came from movies directed by women. You know, you've got this one, you've got League of Their Own, you've got Tank Girl. Like, they understood that Laurie is like weird and fun and crazy and intense and sexy. And I think male directors just kind of would look at Laurie Petty and be like, I don't know what to do with her. She's unlike most women that we have in screen, especially in the 90s. But like, Bigelow shoots Laurie to be like, look how cool she is. Look how strong she is. Look how tough she is. She's also sexy as hell. She can wear a tight dress when she wants to. She can make touchdowns at the football game. She's not cheering. She's scoring touchdowns herself. She's a badass surfer. She's really impatient. And then, yeah, the movie completely sells her out. And it's like, oh, suddenly she's shooting a gun for no reason, which doesn't seem like her. And now she's in a white slip and getting rescued. That kind of sucks. I don't love the extreme turn her character takes, but she starts off so cool.
I know. Who is wearing slips in this time? I mean, it seems like that's like a go-to. Like in Lethal Weapon, I think they kidnap Danny Glover's daughter, yeah, and she's running around in a slip in the middle of the desert,
yeah,
too.
What? Like, Laurie Petty, like, is introduced in this movie changing into jean shorts without bikini bottoms on underneath. We know. We see her take them off under a towel.
Yeah, she's not throwing on slips.
That woman doesn't sleep in a white slip. Are you kidding me? That woman sleeps in a football jersey.
And by the way, that white slip would be full of blood or shit. Here's the other thing. What I like about this movie is, and maybe in the rewatch I'm watching it differently, she kind of rejected Bodhi. Like, there's this idea, I think, you know, maybe when I first saw it, like, Bodhi's like, yeah, you can sleep with my girlfriend, it's cool. But as details come out, it feels like she didn't fall for him. I mean, he says that. She didn't go all the way. Like, she, in many respects, is the alpha in that relationship. And I think that's really interesting too, right? Here's a woman that is a part of a weird love triangle, but not really, because she's rejected Bodhi, but we're going to stay friends. And she's more interested in this other guy who is not Bodhi, which I think also creates a little bit of tension. But Bodhi, because he's so enlightened, is like, whoa, if she likes him more than me, then he's actually worth checking out what's going on here. And I think that that's an interesting dynamic. Like, she actually holds weight without anyone saying it. They don't have a scene where he goes, well, you like him, so maybe I should. It's just all very natural in this environment. And of course she's hanging out in that group of guys. Like, those guys aren't hanging out with like a blonde beach bunny. Like, that's not like somebody that they would bump into or be a. And she's not a part of the crew, but she's a part of.
Yeah. And when we see like the beach bunnies, they're pretty much getting ignored. They're like giving Patrick Swayze a massage. And he's like, yeah, 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 yeah. And he's not really like focused on them. They're not as present as her character is. And also, what I think, where I really feel like a female touch in this film is that it is only Tyler who is able to kind of comment on really what these guys are up to, and that she doesn't think it's honestly that cool. Because if you're watching this movie just solely through the POV of like Keanu and Patrick Swayze, you're like, this is awesome. Taking it to the edge, having a death wish, pushing it too far. But she has all these lines where she's like, what the fuck ever.
There's too much testosterone here. Big wave riding for macho assholes with a death wish.
No, it's not.
I mean, because think about this. We know, like you said, Keanu's lying when he says his own parents died. Her parents have died. She knows what death is.
Yeah.
She's more sensible than them. It's not just like she's a girl and she's a wuss and she thinks it's stupid. She's like, I know what death is and I know what loss is. These guys are stupid. And she sees them for what it is. She cuts through all of it.
And to go to your point about who is the hero, who's not the hero, we do see villains in this movie. I mean, we see it with Anthony Kiedis as Tone, like whatever crew he's a part of, that surfing crew.
The surf Nazis must die or get shot in the foot, at least.
The surf Nazis. I love that crew. And by the way, when Catherine Bigelow casts Anthony Kiedis, he's nobody. Like, this is before Blood Sugar Sex Magik hits, right? So this is, again, just Catherine Bigelow going, there's something here. This can work, right? And so
I wonder if he could even afford courtside seats at the Lakers yet.
Oh, I did get to see Flea one time do the national anthem. It was pretty impressive.
I mean, he was at least like busy enough with his career that one of the jokes was like, they were taking the stunt stuff really seriously. So they're like, everybody's got to show up. Everybody's got to get trained. We're going to learn these stunts. I mean, Keanu knows stunts because he really had to learn them here from the ground up. And the one person who never showed up to stunt practice was Anthony Kiedis because he was like, I'm really busy, bro. And the very first day they did that, like, fighting under the shower at the beach scene, he got knocked the F out and was like, okay, I'm showing up now.
You know, that idea of, like, showing off these real stunts, it does make this movie really visceral. And it's what we talk about when we talked about Mission Impossible. You know, Patrick Swayze was an accomplished skydiver. And so he really... You could tell, like, this is not faked. And when they did the remake, which sucked.
He jumps with no cuts out of a plane. No cuts.
It's so cool, right? I mean, he didn't even want to have a surfing double, you know, because he was so committed to being like, I don't use doubles.
He even, like, blew out his knee playing football, like, on the set.
But by the way, just to go back to Kiedis, you're right. Like, he was like, I'm going to take this seriously. But even if he took it seriously, he gets knocked out with one punch. So I don't think he figured out how to do much stunt work there. He took one punch.
But like the scale even of the big shootout that he's in after that, where what happens to him is he just gets shot in the foot. That to me is the kind of detail I love in an action movie, because you're it doesn't have to be like mow, everybody down and one bullet and everyone's dead. Shooting a person who lives to be athletic in the foot and having it be that gory and that messy is worse than like a million stupid bullets.
That image really burned into my brain as a kid because it really was like something you never saw before. You know, it's like that Eddie Murphy joke where, you know, a guy gets shot, it's like, oh, go on without me. You know, and it's like, and you're like, no, if you have in real life, you'd be like, oh, God. You know, and I feel like that's what that sequence shows is, yeah, these guys are tough. They have a lot of guns and they are that is a violent showdown.
Yeah. And you know who's like the toughest in it, too, even is like one of the guy's girlfriends who's fighting naked. She's ferocious and she's tough. Like that felt like a really pointed touch, which is why it also bums me out that like later on Tyler's like, I don't know.
I know.
Tyler is not, that's not who she is.
It's probably because Roach is so fucking crazy, right? James LaGross. But I just want to, again, just go back to this and say, this is not a movie that wrestles with the gray area of morality. These guys are bad, right? Bodhi, different. But these surf Nazis are bad.
There's no romance in being like crystal meth and selling crystal meth, you know? And they don't even talk about it in the same ways. Like Bodhi's like, they don't even get why they do the crime. They don't see the spirituality in the surfing or in any of it.
Well, I mean, and again, as silly as it sounds, you know, you take any movie and you compact it to its simplest premise, it sounds dumb. Every movie sounds dumb if you compact it to its simple premise.
Newspaper guy dies and he's sad about his sled.
Done. Dumb, dumb, dumb. But there is this thing about Bodhi, which is they only rob banks to finance a lifestyle, to be one with nature, to have this enlightenment. And I want to dig into who is the main character here. And I'm going to say I believe the main character is Bodhi. I don't think the main character is Johnny Utah. I'm glad they changed the name from Johnny Utah to this, because Bodhi, which is short for Bodhisattva, and I apologize if I mispronounced that, but the Bodhisattva is someone who brings people to enlightenment. And this is his journey in this movie. He is bringing Keanu Reeves' character into enlightenment. It's the idea that this is an enlightened person that has said, I don't need to be in heaven, or I don't need to be in a greater plane, because my job is to help others find it, right? And so call me Yoda, but he is the shaman to take this character out. So maybe in a way the protagonist is Johnny Utah. We're watching him, but the real journey here, the real transformation of him, is meeting this character who enlightens him. Because we go from a guy who's about law and order and black and white to someone who at the end is saying, I am no longer a cop. I surf every day. I found my enlightenment, and it's not through black and white.
Yeah, I grew my hair out. I mean, like you said, how two things can be true at the same time. I think this is about how a guru can be genuine, and he can be mind expanding, and he can change your life. And he can also be a little bit hypocritical and full of shit. Because like when he gives
watch his... every Netflix documentary, and you'll find that.
yeah, exactly. I mean, like when he gives his little speech at the end, like after this is all starting to go really bad.
Come on, think about it. This was never about money for us. It was about us against the system. That system that kills the human spirit. We stand for something. To those dead souls inching along the freeways in their metal coffins, we show them that the human spirit is still alive.
I don't know how much I'm supposed to believe him at that point. You know, like, kind of yes, kind of no. He's kind of going too far, I think, in that point. You know, he's kind of like Lady Jessica and Dooning it. Like, no, yeah, I don't know. Maybe here's where we scale it back just a little bit. Like, you're inspiring people on the freeway. You're also just funding your surf trips. Like, let's not completely lie to ourselves here.
You know, there's an idea, though, that this movie is saying, why do we work so hard? Why do we trap ourselves when we are in this world, you know, that is surrounded by this beauty, this nature? Like, why are we so caught up in money and corporations? And, you know, there's an element here. And we saw that with Die Hard too. Like, there's an underlying fear of corporate America at this time, which, you know, completely unfounded, because you see where we are now.
Yeah, it all worked out great. And we love corporations even more.
Worked out great. But I think that's what people are wrestling with. Like, am I just a cog in the machine, or am I something better, grander? And, you know, I think that maybe this movie is saying, to your point, enlightenment is a gray area, because the movie ends in gray. Because Keanu Reeves has grown out his hair. He has given up being a cop. He is surfing all the time. He does make this choice at the end to not be the law and order person. He gets his man and then allows him to reach his enlightenment. And that's why I go back to Bodhi being the main character, because he's like, now you can go. You have enlightened me, and now I let you go on to the next plane. And I feel like that's Keanu Reeves saying, I am now truly enlightened, and that it then releases Bodhi from this world. There's something about that I look at and I go, but it's a gray area. Did he do something right or wrong? And I guess you can look at it in two ways. Do we need to put Bodhi in jail? He did kill people. So, yes.
But I also do feel like he probably would have never killed people if the law hadn't circled in as intensely as it did. But right. Then also, you know, I mean, the whole thing just feels like a waste. It feels like that's the tone I get out of there.
Well, I never understood this final bank robbery. I thought their final bank robbery was the one that we saw when Gary Busey's character, is getting two meatball subs.
Is so hungry at 10:30 in the morning that he's like, I need a meatball sub now, and let's just blow the whole thing because I'm a clown.
But by the way, this is what this movie is about.
But I think that would have been their last robbery.
Yes.
That would have been their last robbery. If then they hadn't like interfered, and then he's like, well, now I got to get him in trouble. Now we got to like do the whole thing. Now I have to fall. Like, I think the tragedy of Bodhi losing his cool is like absolutely gutting because you know he knows better. Everybody knows he knows better. Everybody in the scene is knowing he knows better. And you also get in that whole scene, the people we're supposed to side with, you know, the law and order in there is in that movie. He's like an undercover cop who also happens to be in there. And he's like, I'm going to do the action hero thing. I'm going to make a move. I'm going to save us all. And people are like, don't do it. And he does it and it gets everybody killed.
I mean, that's a brutal death. And you're right. If he would have just played his part, which is just laid down and not try to take on this bank, he would be alive and no one would die. There's so many things I have issues with plot-wise.
Because the bank money is so pathetic, right? Like,
yes.
I mean, you know what this movie really reminded me of on this rewatch? Of all the movies we've covered, it reminded me of a movie we both loved, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, where you go on this whole expedition, all these guys grizzled, going through Mexico, trying to get some gold dust. And at the end, all the gold dust just blows away. And what do we have here on the airplane tarmac? All of the money just blowing away and people being like, well, what was the point of any of this? There was no point to any of this. They escape
and everyone's dead.
Yeah. And I mean, all you can do, it's like an ending so bleak, you know, guys in the middle of a rainstorm, just like in Treasure of Sierra Madre. We almost just wish we could just do that like cosmic creepy laugh you get in that movie.
I mean, look, I would love to have that Bill and Ted kind of laugh at the end of the movie. But
bruh, what did we do that for, bruh?
I think what we're looking at, too, on top of all of this, goes back to what you just said about Gary Busey's character, who when he orders two meatball subs, get me two. By the way, I once saw a shirt that said, Utah, get me two. And I thought that was the best shirt I've ever seen. It was in San Francisco. I love Pappas. But that insatiable appetite, he asked for three. He's like, I should have gotten three. It's everything too extreme. Even a meatball sub order for the guy who is the most straight in this entire film, right? Like the way that Pappas goes in to this, you know, room with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, like they're all pushing the extreme. And what happens there is, yeah, you get that rush. And then sometimes it's going to bite you in the ass. Sometimes you'll get shot. You know, Pappas is so content on getting that shot. He doesn't look behind him. He gets shot. Everyone is pushing to the extremes. It's only a matter of time until your number's called, right? And that's, I think, that the movie underlying is saying. And that's what Lori Petty's saying, that clip that you played earlier. It's macho. It's bullshit. It's like, it's just one-upping each other. It's saying like adrenaline. You do enough stuff with adrenaline, at a certain point, you might have a heart attack. You might just kill yourself.
Or the meatball subs are going to give you a heart attack, you know?
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like everything about it, that meatball sub will kill you as much as skydiving without a parachute will kill you. And you watch that moment where, you know, Keanu has a gun on Bodhi and he's like, pull the cord. He's like, drop the gun, pull the cord. And it's like, these two guys are willing
it's
to.
An idiot game of chicken.
Yes. Which leads me to probably one of. Can we say it's one of the best action sequences in cinema? The foot chase scene in this movie?
Yes. I was waiting to see which sequence you picked out, and I was hoping it was the foot chase because, yes, I do believe that is one of the best action sequences in cinema.
And do you feel like it's also paying homage to Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Running on those halls.
I mean, Ferris Bueller's running through all those houses at the end, it very much is similar.
But it's so good. I mean, I think they put a camera on like a little pogo stick. So just holding a camera on a stick, running and running and running through these narrow hallways. And like, it's the specificity again that like Bigelow brings to the screen. Running into not just some like cute babe in a slip, but running into like a woman holding a stack of towels. The drama you get out of just like, I'm going to lock this one door really fast. And then like, throwing a dog in his face. Like, it's amazing. And then there's, of course, like the moments of grandeur, right? Even when it starts, they're just like, what? That is pure cinema. It is Ronald Reagan mask at a gas station on fire in slow motion. It starts so big, but then it gets so small and so pointed. Skidding down the LA River ramp, all of it, busting your knee. The small pain of busting that football knee he's got. Ugh.
But you also have a movie in which this scene, which is really a game of chess between these two guys, right? In that moment, it's Patrick Swayze versus Keanu Reeves. And Patrick Swayze's face is obscured by that Reagan mask. And you see in his eyes, it's like he's enjoying this. This is not a chase for his life. This is yet another one of these things. Like, I'm going to do everything. Like, it's just, I'm pushing it to the limits. I've never seen so much emotion expressed just through eyes. It really is a brilliant performance. And
I want to imagine what's also in those eyes, though, is Patrick Swayze being like, this was the one thing I couldn't film because I was in Europe doing the Ghost press tour. That was my stunt double under the mask, but they let me do just that pickup shot. I wish I could have done all that chasing.
Oh,
I'm so mad.
Wow. Oh my God. I mean, it is a beautiful scene. It's so electric. This movie does this multiple times where you're just being thrust in. Like, you are also, again, to kind of keep this theme going, you're being thrust into these moments, these scenes. Everything feels like you might die. Like, that's why, like, a guy hurting his bad football knee, that's probably one of the most, like, ooh, pain points of the film. And it's not like a violent, like, we've just did 150 punches into your gut. Like that hurts more. The shooting into the foot, you know, these moments are so much more extreme. Even when they land so messily in that parachute at the end, it's like, it's sloppy. It's
you see
rough.
That they're too tired to keep the chase going. Like, yes. They would, they just physically cannot anymore. But they're tired. Like, a lot of movies just have them pick up and keep going to the breaking point. And here it's like, no, man, she respects the limits of the physical body more than they do, more than the characters do.
And I think that's what makes this movie so interesting. I think, again, going back to Mission Impossible, I think putting real world things, oh, they can really jump from that building to the next. It just makes you appreciate what you're watching. Put this movie next to any action movie with a ton of CGI in it, and I think it will still be as effective as this film. It's like, it's not jumping off a building. It's not exploding helicopters. It's running through people's houses, you know? And yes, they are, you know, jumping out of planes, but even that is shot with such, like, it's just people jumping out of planes. It's so exciting. That new Point Break remake, it's like, we're extreme sports guys or fucking Vin Diesel's XXX. Like, it's all so...
It's so dumb.
Dumb.
I mean, it misses the point, right? Like, the 2015 remake is like, I know what people liked about Point Break. They just liked all the extreme sports. We'll just have more. We'll do, like, surfing and motorbiking and windsuit flying and snowboarding and free solo climbing.
It's not that. Bodies
and eco-terrorists. And you're like, no, man. People like this movie because of, like, the spirituality and the connection.
And also, just to go back to the eco-terrorism, I think what's interesting about this film is we've heard about bank robberies a lot. And I think that, like, bank robberies to me seem so old-fashioned. Like, oh, there are a lot of bank robberies. I mean, when we listen to John C. McGinley come in here and be like, we bust these guys, we get these guys, you know, and you're like, oh, yeah, I'm sure your bank robbery department's really working overtime. But I did do some research, and L.A. was the bank robbery capital of the world for decades, and it actually saw an uptick in the 90s. And in 1992, a year after the film's release, it saw its highest number of bank robberies, with 2,600 in total. That's more than 7 robberies a day on average. So,
yeah, that's like double what the script says is a huge number. And you can tell that because that was the number of bank robberies that were happening in LA when they wrote it in 1986. And it climbed. You could almost wonder if, like, more people were robbing banks after they saw Point Break. Because it's like, it comes out in 91, there's a lot, but there's even more the next year. Like, in 92, there were 28 banks robbed in one day here in LA.
And that to me is like, oh, this is – it actually makes the movie even more interesting to be like, whoa, whoa, oh, this is a real deal thing. Like, it seems so fantastical, right? Oh, they're robbing banks.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does now. Like, do you know how many bank robberies there were in LA last year?
No,
in all of Southern California?
How many?
We went from 2,600 at the year after Point Break to 67 last year.
Wow.
In all of Southern California. In fact, you know, their big number, like 13,000 bank robberies a year. That's basically now all the number of bank robberies in all of America every year.
Okay, interesting. Now, I do want to talk about this idea of why do we have 2,600 bank robberies in this year? Because we're coming out of the 80s, which is Wall Street, greed is good, right? That mentality. And we're going to be going into the 2000s, which is like conservatism, right? That's the birth of, you know, we're kind of pulling shit together. And I feel like there's this moment, the 90s represents this like haves and have nots, right? It's like, I will never achieve this amount of money. I think we're in a similar moment right now in a way. Like, I'll never achieve this kind of wealth, so why don't I get it? Now, yes, there are federal crimes. I'm not saying go out and rob banks.
You're not inspiring people like Bodie to go rob banks.
No, but it's like, but I think there's this desperation of how do I live? How do I live and not work until I have nothing to live for, right? To survive, because we're coming out of just gross excess. And those who don't have it, they're this kind of this in between. You either work to survive or you live this lavish lifestyle. And I think the 90s like is an interesting time. That's of course why I think we have bank robberies up to high. It's like, yeah, take it from them. Robin Hood it.
Yeah. I do wonder, like, bank robberies drop almost immediately in 93. And I wonder if there is something in like the post Reagan Bush era, like anger, and then Clinton kind of is there, right? A tiny little bit of maybe getting or pretending like we're getting a middle class back for a couple of years and leading to like the ennui of American beauty. So there's not as much bank robbing. Also, I just think a lot of crime went online and now we're just scamming people online. But like, yeah, a little easier. But it's interesting. I mean, you see in here even like the way the FBI is going about it. A, they don't even solve as many cases as they pretended to in this movie. But B, like there's all this talk about profiles and data and profiles and data. And when they believe the FBI, when Johnny Utah believes in the FBI system, he winds up just like busting the wrong house of a different type of criminals. He doesn't get the bank robbers. He gets these other guys. It's like he's looking for people who fit what a profile is of what a criminal is, according to the FBI. And the profile is wrong, which leads me to one of the things that I wrestle with when I watch this movie, which is the movie acts like it's a dramatic revelation when he realizes, by recognizing a butt, that it's like his buddies and Bodie who are the bank robbers. But in a way, the movie also just lets you know that it's definitely him who is the bank robber. I think even in the trailers, but definitely when you see the opening montage back and forth of like him and Swayze. So do we miss out on the suspense of being surprised that it's Swayze? Does anybody ever believe that it's not Patrick Swayze when you watch this movie?
You know, it's so funny to even think about that. I didn't even consider that as an element of surprise. You know, I guess you're right, but then why would we even be introduced to Patrick Swayze? Like, I mean,
exactly.
The movie opens, like the movie is very clearly these two guys, but again, it's hard
it's
for
heat,
me to
right?
look at it.
It's
yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you said Heat. We talked about this before the podcast started. I was like, oh, this is Heat. This movie is Heat. It's two people who respect each other and do things differently. Right. And I think it's like, instead of having the one diner scene, this whole movie is the diner scene.
Yeah. And yet, you know, to tie in everything that we've been talking about, we're watching it not just really for the plot, but for like everything we're feeling. Oh, no, here I go. Under the surface of the water. Right.
Yes.
I mean, because we should say this about Bigelow. I should have said this earlier. Like, Bigelow is a person who went to graduate school in film at Columbia. She studied theory. She studied criticism. She comes to this as a director who knows everything about a subtext. So we're seeing the subtext in there, the stuff we're pulling out, you know, the looks between, like, Bodie and Johnny, the looks that Tyler gives both of them, where we know that she knows more about what's happening than they even understand that she knows. You know, there's all of this stuff happening in here about like philosophy, about extremity, about people realizing who they really are, about self-actualization. And Bigelow shows us that Johnny Utah is a guy who's going to break the boundaries of the football game and chase a man into the waves. He's all about the pursuit if it gets him his victory. And he's chasing, you know, Patrick Swayze into the waves again at the end of the movie. Like, this is a really deliberate film where it kind of reminds me of the way, like, we were trained, you know, through the AFI Top 100 to take a cowboy picture seriously. Mm-hmm. And like, oh, yes, cowboy pictures are great art. And they have all of this subtext in cinema. And, you know, I'm talking sarcastic, but that is also true. That is also true here. That is what this movie is. It's a modern cowboy bank robbery movie done with just, I think, great intelligence.
This is a movie that the action set pieces are truly unbelievable, beautifully shot. You know, the camera work, everything, cinematography, across the board, great. But really, the core of this movie is about these two guys wrestling with how to live life. It is about, you know, humanity and spirituality and doing your job versus living your life. I think that, you know, in many ways, like True West or something like that, it can live in that space.
Exactly. Like, we always reduce, say, cowboy movies, to keep this analogy going, to like black hat, white hat, good hat, bad guy. But like, the best cowboy movies muddle that. This movie is very much muddling that. It's all about gray. You know, it is about figuring out what hat you're wearing. And if you want to wear that hat at the end of the film, and if you want to throw it into the surf.
Let's bring it one step forward and say, what wins the Oscar the following year? Unforgiven. A movie about a cowboy who is neither black nor white, like kind of meta version of a story with our cowboy. It's our John Wayne. It's like, I guess, what The Searchers was, even though I don't like The Searchers. But to me, Unforgiven really hones that exact same thing. There is this other. Two things can be true. You can be good, but you can be bad, which then, let's move that all the way forward and go to John Wick.
Yes. And you know what? And that actually, I think, triple underscores the point that I have churning in my stomach right now, which is there was a time when we didn't take Clint Eastwood seriously as an actor. There was a time when we didn't take cowboy pictures that seriously. Then we get so used to the genre that we like are willing to look for the subtext in them, and so used to the actor that we're willing to look for the greatness in him. We got to do cycles. It took us 30 years to get used to the idea that a movie about bank robbing surfers could be serious.
Right. It's a movie that also, you know, we said it in the beginning that Ridley Scott was first excited to direct this movie because he wanted to make something like Tony Scott. Tony Scott, to me, is a director that doesn't get enough props. Mm-hmm. Because I think Tony Scott, more than any other filmmaker of like the last maybe like three decades, knew how to consistently make popcorn movies. Like, they are fun, big films, whether it's Unstoppable, whether it is, you know, Top Gun, they just have this energy that's like, that's why we go see movies. We want to be pulled into this world. We want to have fun with the world. We're not going to make you think too much. It's just like, enjoy the spectacle. And I think that what Kathryn Bigelow does here is she does, like Ridley Scott wanted to do as well, take that mantle and go, and I can also make it a little bit smarter too. But at the same time, and this is where her talent comes in, you won't even notice it. At the end of the day, you're going to think about surfing bank robbers and you're going to leave and you're going to be like, that was great. But now, 30 years later, we can look at it and go, oh shit. It's subversive enough that unless you're looking for it, you won't see it. It's like a magic trick. It's there.
Exactly.
It's, it, you know?
And then when you're looking for it, then you're noticing things like, wow, there's scenes where Lori Petty looks in his dress basically exactly like Keanu Reeves and what is happening. She's hanging around, like, what she's really sleeping in this movie, she's sleeping in his shirts, unbuttoned the way a guy would be wearing that shirt unbuttoned. And I'm like, what does Bigelow mean by that? And honestly, I still don't totally know. Except that I think she's pushing at our idea of even what movies think is sexy. She's like, no, other shit is sexy besides like bikini blonde girls. Lori Petty is sexy as hell.
Oh,
and she's pushing us in that direction.
And I'll just say, you know, the other part of this to me, I think why Keanu Reeves is pegged by Bodhi as someone who is open for something is like this idea of the spiritual wounds that we all carry with us. We don't know what Bodhi's spiritual wounds are, right? No one's going to reveal them to us. We, you know, that's a different tale. But this idea of Keanu Reeves was a star football player. He was going to be the next quarterback, the next Tom Brady.
Joe Montana. That's why his name Johnny Utah.
Yeah, right? That's hilarious. I didn't even think about how dumb that is.
The next Duncan, Idaho.
It's so close to being in Dune. But it's this moment of like, he is chasing that rush that he had, that thing where he was going to be, everyone paid attention, he would be happy. Like, and this is what he's trying to chase, is that he is an adrenaline junkie because he couldn't get his dream. And there's this unresolved piece in his, he's unsound. Like at his core, there's something that needs to be fixed. And he goes this other way.
Yeah. Like even in that scene where he is straight up lying to Tyler about his parents, about his life, about why he wants to surf. It's kind of like he, when you really listen to what he's saying, it feels like he's playing, you know, two truths and a lie.
Mm-hmm.
My whole life, I've done things for other people. In high school, I played football because my old man expected me to. Mm-hmm. And my parents always figured I'd go to law school. So I did. Football scholarship, Phi Beta Kappa.
Is this going to take a really long time?
Wait. So I'm a big hero to my folks, right? Mm-hmm. But 2 years ago, they were killed in a car wreck. You can't imagine it. Your whole life changes. And I suddenly realized that all my goals had been their goals, and I hadn't been living my own life. So I wanted something for myself.
I believe, actually, most of that speech. I believe that he hasn't ever done completely what he wanted to be doing with his life, and that he was living his life based on other people's terms. Why would this guy be in the FBI? It doesn't even make any sense. He doesn't want to be in the FBI. And you know what? The only sensible thing is for him to leave the FBI at the end. We don't know what's right for him, but we know that that's wrong.
Yeah, I really love what this movie is. And I think it shows, as somebody who loves action films, it shows, you know, you can give us two different flavors at once. You can give us something that actually has some weight, but also totally scratches that itch, you know? And I think that sometimes somewhere along the line, everything had to become a little bit more elevated. And I hope that we kind of get back to this place where we can have a fun movie theater experience. It's not like a Marvel movie, but we can kind of inject it in a little bit, but it also doesn't have to just become semi, you know, self-serious. It's like the way I hate dramedies. Like dramedies just took over and it became that, like, yes, they're great ones, but for the most part, it's just this muddled thing that's neither a comedy nor a drama. And it just feels like, what am I getting? I want to see a big, bold comedy. I watched, you know, you ask anybody, like, what's your favorite comedy movie that you've seen recently? It's hard. They don't make them anymore because people are afraid to make them. You know, it's like, and
yeah, but in the case of this, I feel like we're also seeing the limits of that because, you know, this movie does it all right. You know, it is about deep ideas and it is also really fun. And you know what? Nobody noticed that it was about deep ideas for a really long time.
Right.
And right. That's so brutal. It's so brutal, but it does it exactly right. I mean, you could have had Keanu Reeves turn to the camera and say, also, this is about my trauma that I didn't get to be a football star.
Right.
And then you could have Bodhi turn to the camera and say, also, let me tell you one fact about myself that, maybe my parents died in a car wreck. Maybe a surfboard killed my mother. I don't know. And then you'd be like, oh, yes, this is a really serious film. And it doesn't do it because we shouldn't have to have it do that to take it seriously.
I 100% agree with you. I think this movie is a movie that people probably, when they saw it in their listing today, was like, oh, how could they talk about this? I like it better when they talked about the AFI movies. But I do believe that this movie is important for a handful of reasons. One, show me a director with a better run than Kathryn Bigelow at this point, right? From what she's doing and really just a body of work that I don't think you even realize, like her body of work was so fucking strong because I think that they were these lower budgeted films that didn't need to make $200 million, you know, but Near Dark is great. Like, you know, her movies are great. Strange Days is weird and fun and whatever, you know, it's like, but that movie made a big effect on me. I love Strange Days, you know, when I saw it.
And you know what? I feel like if you put Point Break next to Hurt Locker and you asked me to say which one is best and which one would I rewatch and which one maybe deserved maybe the Oscar more, I would point break. And I'm nervous even saying that Point Break deserves an Oscar because I'm not saying that yet. Maybe I'll say that in 10 more years. Maybe I need some more time to sit with it. But I didn't love Hurt Locker, and I do think this is the superior film. I also do think I would like Hurt Locker better if you just cut out like half of the movie.
And I think that, you know, just thinking back to her work that she's done recently too, it's like Zero Dark Thirty to me is you get some of this amazing action, and you get it in Hurt Locker too. I mean, those scenes, I haven't seen Hurt Locker since 2008, but I can remember how I felt watching him disarm bombs.
Those are great scenes.
Yeah, I remember the Zero Dark Thirty raid. Like, and I haven't seen these movies. I haven't seen them in such a long time. I remember the foot getting a bullet through it in Point Break. Like, these are the things that stick out in my head. The end of Strange Days with the confetti coming down. Like this, there are just images that she creates that are truly one of a kind.
And I think it's fashionable, and I'm probably guilty of it too, of saying like, well, Bigelow just directs like a man. You know, like, she's not really but a female director. She directs like a man. And I'm sure I've said that at least a little bit, that she's tried to be, maybe about her more recent stuff, because it hasn't hit me as hard as this one does. But here, I think she's doing the perfect synergy of, like, there is a personality here that is not the standard issue personality. And yet, it is a film that is excelling at all the rubrics that the films like this do not excel at. It's better at everything.
I think you get something more akin to Top Gun, where the homoeroticism is like, I don't know. There's a difference between those two movies. This movie, I think you empathize with both guys. I think that you feel for both guys. I think it makes it hard to go, who's the protagonist? Who's the antagonist?
When Bodhi's crew dies, it is awful. Yeah. And we grieve. The movie grieves for
them. And that, to me, is the difference. There is a difference there. And look, you grieve for Goose in Top Gun. I think she's doing something really interesting that not many people can do. I think she elevates the action movie.
Yeah. And you know how I know that you're sincere when you say that is, I remember this. Let's throw back to this old episode. The big action movie that countered it after this, you're not a fan. Speed.
I am not. No, I don't like Speed. I think it's a dumb movie. And I, as a kid, I liked it because I had simpler tastes. And you know what? And I'll tell you this much. It's fine. But it's not one I'm going to revisit. Like, yes, got a great soundtrack. Yes, Jeff Daniels great. Yes, everything is cool. Fun. It's not a great movie. And I love action. I will watch Beekeeper 20 times before I would watch Speed again. It's just not that great. Jan de Bont, I love you, but not that great.
Okay. So, Paul, next week, we've got a holiday that I think we should celebrate. In an interesting way. I mean, here we've done a movie all about how a female director just really gets inside the head of two men. I want to do a movie that I deeply love that to me is a great example of a male director getting so wonderfully inside the head of a young woman based on a book written by a man as well. A young woman with a terrible mother. So in honor of Mother's Day, I'm very excited to say that we are finally doing a film I've been wanting to do forever. We are doing Brian De Palma's Carrie.
Okay. I am excited about this genuinely because I've never seen Carrie.
What?
Yeah. I don't
know
how.
I didn't know that.
Never have seen Carrie. I don't know how this movie passed over me. I kind of feel like it's a movie where I've seen the cover box of her being drenched in blood. I'm like, got it. That's the movie, right? And I know that it's wrong, but I have never seen Carrie.
Oh my God. This is so exciting. I am so excited for you.
Well, I can't wait. Carrie is available wherever you get your films online. You can also use your library apps to get this movie to stream right to your devices. I can't wait to chat with you about Carrie. What a month of fun bangers here. All right, Amy, that is it. That's our show. Join us next week for Carrie. Our show could not be done without our team, and a huge thank you goes to them each and every week. Produced and edited by Cody Fisher and our associate producer, Jessica Cisneros. Our engineer is Casey Holford, and our MVP is Molly Reynolds. Our theme song is by Michael Cassidy, and our fan art is by Kim Troxell. Check it out all on social media, and you can find us on social media at Unspooled on Twitter and Instagram, and you can join in the conversation about all things Unspooled on the Paul Scheer Discord at discord.gg/Paul Scheer. There's an entire Unspooled section T-shirts, mugs, stickers, and all Unspooled merch are available at tpublic.com/unspooled, and you can get a deck of Unspooled playing cards and more merch at podswag.com. That's right. And if you can't get enough Unspooled, you can listen to our archive for free anywhere you get your podcast. But remember to rate and review us. It does help. And finally, you can always check out the API list. That's right, the ever-growing list that we will eventually shoot into space at unspooled.com. And just a reminder, my book, Joyful Recollections of the Trauma, comes out May 21st. You can pre-order it now, and if you do, I'll be so thankful. See you next time. Bye for now.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.